Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hello and welcome back to the Prospect Podcast. I'm Ellen Halliday, Deputy Editor at Prospect, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Will Hutton, an economist, a columnist for The Observer, and an author whose new book, This Time No Mistakes, How to Remake Britain, was published just a couple of weeks ago in April. Will, thank you for joining us on the podcast.
Pleasure to be here.
Will, your book grapples with what is a pretty dire economic situation, pretty poor economic conditions in the UK today, and looks at what those conditions would mean if Labour were to be the next government, as the polls predict. So, I mean, tell us, just how bad, in your view, is the economic picture in this country?
I'm not going to surprise you by saying I think it's the immediate conjuncture isn't great, but kind of more worrying, I think, is the medium term kind of trends are really kind of very dismaying. It looks as though the what economists call the trend rate of growth, which, you know, right up until the financial crisis of 2007-08 was running at around 2.75%. It's probably about half that, and it may even be lower than that. And that is the kind of lowest growth rate that actually this country's ever experienced as a trend, you know, since 1945. And you have to go a long way back even to find it as bad as that. And that reflects itself in, you know, stagnant real wages. It reflects itself in stagnant productivity, which is the kind of wellspring of, you know, real wage growth. I'm not that worried about public debt as long as we can retain the tax base to assure the financial markets we can service it. I am worried about the growth of external claims on the UK. I mean, empire, kind of Commonwealth, kind of most of the European Union. Britain had always a positive international balance sheet. That's to say, the assets we held overseas always exceeded kind of the what we owed foreigners who were investing here. Actually, that's turned negative in a big way the last 20 years. Mm-hmm. And there's every sign it's going to get worse. So, you know, our international balance sheet's bad. Our public sector balance sheet's bad. Our corporate balance sheets are overstretched. Productivity is poor. Households are in trouble. It's not a great picture. There are shafts of light in that. I mean, we do have lots of startups and scale-ups. There are areas where we're at the frontier of technology. If you've got a government who knew what they were doing, there's plenty to build on. Mm-hmm. So, you know, don't, you know, as you listen to this, you know, kind of like Edward Munch's The Scream, you know, say, so it's all gone to hell in a handbasket. It wouldn't be hard to put it back together again.
Despite that list of woes that you've reeled off, you talk in your book about actually sort of seeing a glass half full situation. Why is that?
Well, that's why I say, I mean, I, you know, it's very easy to get very pessimistic about our conjuncture. I mean, Britain, I mean, there's no doubt about it, since 2010, accentuated since Brexit in 2016, mm-hmm. we are living in a country in economic decline, and actually its standing in the world has fallen remarkably, and it's also a very fractured society. I mean, I should point out They have 4 million, 4.3 million kids who report that they go hungry for at least some days every month. Mm-hmm. You know, we should report that as a result of malnutrition, we have the shortest five-year-olds in Europe. Life expectancy in large parts of the country is actually stagnant and in some parts actually falling. That's the first thing that's happened since the Industrial Revolution. So this economic kind of balance sheet is tipping over into a social balance sheet. Why do I say the glass is half full? I say the glass is half full, building on what I said in an earlier answer, that actually a lot of this is the consequence of actually catastrophic decision-making by a political party in thrall to a philosophy and ideas that are just 100% wrong. They've not accepted a role for public agency. They've not built up economic institutions that could kind of marshal resource and marshal investment. They've flipped and flopped. They really don't know what they're doing. Mm-hmm. And actually that's reflected kind of in the fragmentation of the Conservative Party into a kind of federation of warring cults who are each other's throats because they literally don't know what to do. And each one is saying, well, I know the way through, and they can't command a majority. And in that situation, a political party falls apart. You know, with some coherence in government, you know, with some sustained increase in public investment, with some reasonable shaping of our savings and investment institutions, kind of building on the vast number of kind of high-tech frontier technology startups, we could in 10 or 15 years turn the situation around. So rather than be despairing and saying the glass is half empty and emptying, which I think it would be if the Conservative Party was elected again, I mean, I think it would be really man the lifeboats. They don't know what they're doing, and they have forfeited the right to govern, in my view. I've got a great many friends who are conservatives, who lean conservative. I know people who have been at the top of the Conservative Party who I like, but they will concede privately they forfeited the right to govern. We have to have a different government in. I think we will get one, and I have reasonable hopes. And I'm not starry-eyed or wide-eyed, but I have reasonable hopes that Keir Starmer and his team will put it back together again.
I mean, the British public has seen for themselves, you know, the arguments within the Conservative Party in recent years, the changes of leadership of government as well. But the idea that they don't know what they're doing is also a criticism that many would level at Labour. People do say that they hear too little from Starmer and Rachel Reeves about what Labour would do if they were in power. What do you make of that criticism?
30 seconds, then an answer. The 30 seconds I want to say, and I think it's really important to put on the table, is that ever since Mrs. Thatcher's election in 79, kind of centre-right and kind of libertarian-right economic policy has been built around the notion that, you know, the individual and individualism should be the centre of the moral, economic and social universe. There's been catastrophic error after catastrophic error: monetarism, deindustrialization, financial deregulation leading to the great financial crash, the mindlessness of austerity, Brexit itself, capped by the Liz Truss budget. And there's been lots of subplots within that kind of big terrain, which have been kind of equally catastrophic. That's why the country is reeling. And so when I say they don't know what they're doing, it's because, you know, the best answer they can come up with is to double down on the mistakes they've made. Now, you're right. The Liberal left, the Labour Party in particular, but I mean, the Liberal left in the round, should have a better fist at actually taking this on. Labour alternate between a kind of cautious, verging on timid pragmatism and kind of ideological socialist zealotry. And that's been the story since the foundation of the party in 1900. And they haven't got a kind of line of sight on what a kind of liberal left ideology should be. Now, what I try to do in the book is to kind of say what it should be, kind of looking at kind of what the great thinkers of before the foundation of the Labour Party and since have been saying. And I argue for an ethic of the social, if you want to turn it into a belief system, ethic of socialism, which informs creating a social floor below which no one should fall, and progressive liberalism, which actually, yes, acknowledges the importance of I, the individual, but actually say, and we must have ladders up which everybody can climb, but framed and tempered by some sense of obligation to society of which one is part, and within a capitalism that recognises its obligations to the society of which it is part. Now, that's my vision. And actually, I argue that the great reforming governments of the 20th century, the Liberal government of 1906-14 and the great Attlee government of 45-51, did hold that in mind. And it's been lost sight of, and kind of vicious sectarianism. Kind of, you can list, you know, the Bevanites in the 50s, the Footites in the and the Benites in the late 70s, early 80s, the Corbynites more recently. I mean, and then the kind of centre right of the party regaining control, and then actually being kind of Tory light in a way. And I think if you can get that philosophy right, then, which I think Starmer has got a line of sight on, actually. I mean, he did come to one of the launches of the book and say that he kind of thought it was brilliant, and he seemed to have read it. So, and I'm, you know, I'm boastful, I know, but I just want to give listeners a sense that actually this man is not kind of as unrooted or floating free of kind of centre-left thinking than some people kind of think he does. Mm. So, I mean, why am I hopeful? Because Rachel Reeves gave the Mays lecture back in March, in which she argued, in a mild way, but in the terms of the book, the need for taking a public investment, a big increase in public investment, as the kind of head of a kind of arrow, if you like, of kind of trying to create some kind of economic kind of waves around which, you know, the private sector could be crowded in to investment.
Can you explain a bit more what that means?
This is so vital, because the thinking of the last 45 years, less so during the New Labour years, but to a degree they bought into it, was that actually public borrowing and public endeavour crowds out the private. And the private is not only morally superior, but actually economically and socially superior to anything the state or public agency can do. I turn it on its head, and I am a follower of John Maynard Keynes, and he argued, and I think he's right, that it's the other way around, that actually public investment and public borrowing crowds in business investment, and wherever you look, that's what goes on. So, you know, you invest in R&D in our great universities, and it crowds in business startups feeding off the technology and ideas created. You build HS2, expensive, but it's going to last a long time. That crowds in kind of lots of businesses along the line, and lots of contractors making the trains and the railway line and the tunnels and all the rest. Public investment, whether it's levelling up, whether it's infrastructure, whether it's driving to net zero, decarbonising the national grid, crowds in private activity. It's the exact inversion of every single sentence you've heard from a Conservative politician since 1979. And it's really important to kind of understand that. And actually, in fairness, Rachel Reeves turned it on its head. So, you know, there is hope.
I mean, that's a very rousing idea, and you speak about it with great energy. But where is that money going to come from for Labour to initiate that public investment? How are they going to pursue these grand projects that of the likes of which you're talking about?
Well, the first thing to say is that this country is rich and it has enormous resource. It's just a question of tapping it. Since 1980, wealth in private and business hands has doubled as a share of national income to more than £15 trillion. Was 3.5 times national income. It's now 7 times national income. And it's almost not taxed. And the yield from that is is pitiful. So, for example, council tax is still based on 1991 values. Cattle gains tax is very low, 28%, and even as low as 18%. Inheritance tax is kind of optional for most people, unless they don't organise their tax affairs very well. A lot of hue and cry about the kind of boom in inheritance tax revenue, which had gone up by hundreds of millions rather than billions. The centre-right press kind of saying, that's the end of the world. You know, it's tiny increases in inheritance tax. It's a voluntary tax. These taxes need to be the yield from them, as I argue in the book, could at least be 1% of GDP, if not kind of close to 2% of GDP. You can phase it in, you can organise it so that it's livable with. And that gives you a tax base, which gives you the kind of debt service capacity for the extra public borrowing that you'll want to undertake. Once you've got the economy moving, you will start to get tax revenues coming in, and you have the capacity then maybe to lower tax rates across the piece. But you've got to jumpstart it with an increase in public investment, keep the financial markets happy by ensuring them you've got the tax is to service the kind of loans they're making to us, and off you go.
After the break, we'll talk more about how Will sees Labour's vision and values. But first, I'd like to tell you about the upgraded digital experience you can enjoy with the new Prospect app. Stay informed and engaged with our independent journalism at your fingertips. Read or listen anywhere, at any time. The app not only gives you access to our articles, but also includes audio narration, plus podcasts like the one you're listening to right now. Subscribe to Prospect and get instant access to the new app, available on iOS and Android.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
How do you think Labour should sell the idea of these taxes to a public who are feeling squeezed, who may feel rightly or wrongly that that would have a negative impact on them?
Well, the first thing to say is that one of the reasons why they feel like that is because it's true. Because the wealthy are not putting their shoulder to the collective wheel, income tax and VAT and national insurance contributions, until they were cut recently by Chancellor Jeremy Hunt, were at 60-year highs. They would have been lower had there been more resource coming in from the wealthy. I quote Francis Bacon in the book, great father of British empiricism, a great philosopher, who wrote in 1625, which is nearly, if I'm doing my maths right, 400 years ago, that wealth is like muck, best if it be spread around. I don't think Francis Bacon even knew what the word socialism was, or even or redistribution, but he did understand, like every farmer, that actually if you have muck piled up and a compost heap at the corner of the farm and don't spread it, you don't get much yield from the fields. We've got to start spreading wealth around in Britain. And actually, the right have been very talented. I mean, they call the inheritance tax death tax. I think let's start talking about wealth being like muck and spreading it around. For example, you just have to come up with a better narrative about what you're trying to do. And actually, what you're trying to do is to generate a capitalism that serves the common good. I'm pro-capitalist. I mean, I when I walk around a young company that's been founded 5-10 years ago by people who are inspiring, trying to make the world better with some invention, I find myself uplifted. It's fantastic to see. And I talk about a floor and a ladder. And I want to see capitalist dynamism, and people climbing up ladders. Don't think of me as a kind of leveling down guy. What I'm trying to say, though, there is a common wheel. There is a we. And that actually, the language for too long has all been about the I and not about the we. And I'm trying to combine the I and the we in what I call a we society.
Do you think that the markets would now welcome a Labour government? You're talking with confidence,
yes,
about the economic,
yes,
thinking.
I think they would welcome a Labour government for a number of reasons. One, they're not stupid, and they can see that this Tory government has forfeited the right to govern and is divided against itself and is unlikely to produce any political and economic coherence in strategizing for the country in another five-year term. They can see that. Secondly, British shares are undervalued, and British public debt is cheap by international standards. And if they start to see that there's a government in place that actually knows which way is up, it'll start buying those financial assets because it can see there's money to be made. Thirdly, the intellectual zeitgeist has changed. I mean, it's not just me saying this. It is, you know, in the book I quote the IMF, I quote the World Bank, I quote Nobel Prize winners. I mean, this isn't kind of just, you know, Will Hutton's wonderful street into your pod room here in the auditorium and kind of, you know, kind of venting stuff that he's just thought up. I'm part of a zeitgeist, and actually the financial markets are part of that zeitgeist. I mean, they didn't believe Liz Truss's libertarian tax cuts that were unfunded. For two reasons. One, they were unfunded. Secondly, they knew they'd produce very little growth, and the idea they'd be self-financing was bonkers. When they hear a plan like this, which they know has got the prospect of being self-financing, because it's structured in ways which they understand, where there's lots of evidence across many countries that this works, they'll actually buy our debt. So I'm not... And they'll hold sterling. They won't sell sterling down the river. So I'm not... I mean, you have to go step by step. You have to be cautious. I think Reeves will be cautious. She'll keep her actions within an envelope of possibility rather than being kind of, you know, as daring as perhaps I would like her to be. But I do understand why she'd be like that. The direction of travel, though, is very clear.
Who is Rachel Reeves talking to and listening to get an idea of what to do in office?
It's very tightly held, the inner circle of the Labour Party. I mean, I went to her maid's. She invited me to her maid's lecture. There were a lot of people in the room that I think she thought were sympathetic to her point of view, or she wanted to persuade. So, and she tells me she's reading my book, and Keir Starmer says he's read it. As I said earlier, you know, the book is drawn from many, many others who are writing in the same vein. I mean, Paul Johnson, who's director of the Institute of Fiscal Studies, writes in this vein about taxing and spending. You know, Angus Deaton, who's a Nobel Prize winner, is leading an inquiry at the Institute of Fiscal Studies on inequality. The Resolution Foundation, Torsten Bell and Gavin Stapp have kind of, I think they have wires into the Labour leadership. But all of us are kept slightly at distance. I mean, they really hold their cards close to their chest. And you get a kind of, you know, you get a glimpse of direction of travel. You have got five missions, one of which is to be the highest growth economy in the G7. That's not easy to do unless you kind of buy into the kinds of things that I and others are talking about. So, I mean, I think some of it, she's got some interesting, some of the people she's talking to on her business council and on her infrastructure council, I think are quite interesting too. I think they're the more progressive kind of in the British business community. So, you know, I mean, it's not, she, as I say, I mean, the inner sanctum is kind of jealously guarded, and the likes of me only get tantalizing glimpses, but the glimpses I get are encouraging.
Mm-hmm. Will, you mentioned Labour's five missions. What do you make of those policies, that kind of policy agenda?
Well, I think they're good. I mean, I think if they were delivered, you know, they would be transformative. You know, highest growth in the G7, kind of decarbonisation by 2030, opportunity for all through kind of radical kind of revision, reform and expenditure in our kind of education and training system, getting NHS to kind of work and public health, mental health, the whole damn piece, social care, and lastly, safer streets. I mean, I think if one could pull those five things off, it would be transformative. My concern about it is that it's not housed in a kind of moral... Mm-hmm. I do think that there's a kind of... You know, politicians who sell visions, you know, have to have some kind of, you know, have to stand on some moral ground and have to have some kind of inner fire. And I've tried to sketch out what I think that should be. I mean, a marriage of an ethic of socialism or an ethic of the social, if you prefer, and progressive liberalism, you know, fused. I think with exemplars of what that means is kind of where the British public largely are. Not all of them, but I think there's a majority to be built there. And I think if he was to talk that language, and it would kind of bind the five missions into something that, oh, that's quite a big deal, Keir. If then you could find within each vision two, three eye-catching, feasible, doable things which actually put kind of flesh on the blood of this mission, you would have something to say. Mm-hmm. We're not there yet.
Yeah, I mean, you've talked maybe about the it being the time for Starmer to stop being timid and to be a bit bolder. In that vision, you also have talked about the importance of kind of, I guess, like a moral standing. And I mean, that surely is one of the big challenges that Starmer has right now, within, you know, within some groups of Labour is the idea that he's not a man who's showing his values, who's expressing his values.
Whether no, I mean, I do know him better than most, although that's not well enough. I mean, he's a good guy. You know, he's straight, he's loyal, he's courteous, he's clever. He can be ruthless when he needs to be. He knows what direction of travel he wants to take the Labour Party. He knows the depth of the problems confronting the country. He knows what his first move should be. He knows how to run a team. He ran the department. You know, he was director of public prosecutions, which he alleged, which to all by all accounts he ran well. You know, he's got a lot of stuff going for him actually, and importantly, he's kind of nearly 20 years older than Rachel Reeves. So the kind of rivalry that Blair and Brown had, and actually the tensions between Osborne and Cameron, are not going to happen because, you know, there's no way. I mean, the likely successors are so much younger than him, they can let him have a run at being leader and prime minister before they get kind of, in political terms, kind of, you know, ratty and trying to challenge him. So I think, you know, the thing will settle quite well.
Can he inspire people?
Look, I launched the book at Ewan Chapel in North London, and Keir said he would come and speak at the launch, and 500 or 600 people turned up. I think it was more than 600 actually, nearly 700 turned up at the launch, and we couldn't say that he might come because we didn't know he would come until and anyway, there were security concerns, and so it was going to be me and Alistair Campbell chatting about the book. But actually he did come, and we held him back for 2 or 3 minutes because we thought it'd be fun to kind of reveal him. Let's see what the Labour leader has to say about this. Well, actually, as it happens, he's here. And he came on stage. And what was interesting, you know, no one knew he was going to be there. And then there was a moment's kind of beat pause. And then there was some clapping. And then there was some cheering. And then there was some whoops and cheering. And it was kind of, everyone was taken aback by the welcome he got. And it, kind of basking in that, you can hear it on kind of the YouTube if you want to click into it. He became very expansive. He really carried his audience with him in a way I hadn't seen before. He's capable of it. But I mean, he's so, I mean, look, 2 years ago, we're speaking at the end of kind of April. You look at the polls 2 years ago, mm-hmm. The Labour were behind the polls. Mm-hmm. 2 years earlier, they'd been actually shattered in a kind of terrible election defeat, the worst since 1935, and they'd nearly split in the 12 months before that. I mean, this is a party on its knees. The French Socialist Party is no more. And I mean, there were lots of smart people saying, you know, it's all over for Labour. And I remember one of the chairs of the Tory Party, you know, the many, many chairs of the Tory Party, kind of proclaiming that Boris Johnson was a new Winston Churchill type figure. He could govern for as long as he liked, at least 10 years. You know, he was our national leader forever and ever and ever. That was the mood of the country. Mm-hmm. And actually, he's adopted the strategy of kind of giving the Tories and the kind of whole right-wing ecosystem little to aim at, and it's working for him. He knows that actually kind of that how disliked and detested in parts of the country the Conservative Party is, and that actually he doesn't have to, that he can ride that way without actually having to kind of risk and maybe fall in trying to be kind of charismatic and persuade you and me that he's got that he's got this moral vision. I mean, I'd like to see him actually show a bit more of what he showed at the Union Chapel, and what I know he can do. He likes to say, and you know, here we are 6 months from a general election, I suspect, he likes to say that there will be a gear change when he wins. We'll see.
We've talked about the events that have perhaps played into Labour's hands in a way in the past couple of years within the Tory party. We're speaking a couple of hours after Hamza Yousaf, the First Minister of Scotland, announced his resignation. That also seems like it may aid Labour in making the case that it is the party across the country that's there and ready to govern. What do you make of that news?
Hamza Yousaf's resignation. There's a lot of support in Scotland for Scottish independence, and that's not going to go away very rapidly. There was a contrast. It's over 100 years ago when Ireland went for independence, and actually the Irish were much more united and systematically supportive of Irish nationalism than is in Scotland, where remains a strong Conservative and a very strong Labour and Lib Dem vote. The Scots are only, they're not quite, they're half converted to this cause. But sufficient of them are converted to probably to stay with the party. I mean, I don't buy the idea that actually the SNP vote is going to collapse. That said, I mean, what's happened to Hamza Yousaf, and particularly the charge of embezzlement from Nicola Sturgeon's husband. So, and my view is that, I mean, there may even be an election in Scotland. Probably a minority government will be cobbled together. And I think a lot of people, especially in the Central Belt and around Edinburgh and in Glasgow too, actually, will actually recognise the importance of actually having Labour MPs in the House of Commons and not SNP MPs. So I'm looking for, 20 or more Labour MPs coming back into the House of Commons from Scotland, which will make it easier for Starmer to form a government, yeah.
Well, listen, Will, thank you very much for taking the time to come and speak with us and for sharing some of the insights from your book launch. I'm sure people can go and check out the video. Where can they watch it?
It's on YouTube, and it was an organisation called Intelligence Squared who actually laid on the event, and it's on their website.
Well, we'll put a link somewhere so people can go.
Yeah,
and
I think. I mean, people don't have to watch all of it, but they can watch the first 10 minutes. And they'll get a flavour of what it was like. And actually, you see a Keir Starmer that's kind of more human, more bubbly, more assured. Here's the point. I put the point to him about the Francis Bacon quote. I said to him, look, in the book, I mean, I argue that, quoting Francis Bacon, that wealth is like muck, best be spread around. You don't need to have to give, hostages to electoral fortune. But actually, what do you react to that as a philosophy? And as you'll see when you watch it, he says immediately, the Labour Party is in favour of redistribution and always will be. And again, you'll hear, the audience go, what am I hearing? So I think in broad terms, much more cautiously than I would like, or I spell out in my book, but I think in broad terms, they'll move in the direction that I've suggested, and not just me, others are suggesting. And I think we can put this country back together again.
Well, Will, thank you very much for joining. It's been a pleasure to have you on.
That's all for now. Thanks so much to Will for joining us, and thanks to our listeners at home for tuning in. If you enjoyed this podcast, head to our website at prospectmagazine.co.uk or to our app, where you can read Will's excellent essay, as well as Peter Kellner's analysis of the latest polls, our editor Alan Rusbridger on who owns the Jewish Chronicle and why it matters, and Sheila Hancock on why she's giving up the bad habit of judging people by appearances. Goodbye for now, and see you next time.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, welcome to the Next Wave podcast. Consider us your chief AI officer in your business. My name is Matt Wolf. I have the number one YouTube channel in the AI space. I also run futuretools.com, and I'm joined by my co-host, Nathan Lands, founder of lore.com. We want to bring you the latest AI news and trends, show you how you can use AI in your business and personal life, and help make it super easy for you to understand and execute. We're going to equip you with the knowledge to thrive in this upcoming wave of change.